How many of you have heard of Harry S. Truman? Anybody want to tell me who he was? One person? Who was Harry S. Truman? You all raised your hands and not one person knows who he was. All right. He was president from 1945 until 1952, right? How many would say yes? Raise your hands. Wait a minute. You raised your hands a minute ago. Do you have a different Harry Truman in mind? How many have a different Harry Truman in mind? All right. Now, I'm not going to let you off the hook. This is not a tough question. I'm going to ask, how many of you have heard of Harry S. Truman? Raise your hands. How many of you know he was president from 1945 till 1952? Raise your hands. Commit yourself. Wrong. I did not say Harry F. Truman. I said Harry S. Truman. Harry S. Truman lived on Mount St. Helens until 20 years and 2 days ago. Do any of you remember Harry S. Truman? Any of you remember him? A subject of folk legend. An 84-year-old, old curmudgeon, as I guess. I've never used the word before, but it just seems to fit this guy. Because I remember him on the national news being interviewed. I'll never leave this mountain. I've lived here all my life, and I'll die here. And guess what? He did. He literally died when a blast of air, 660 degrees in temperature, hit him and vaporized him. And he said, I'm part of this mountain. And as the saying goes, he's reading on the front page of USA Today on Thursday, the 20th anniversary, the front cover, you know, return to St. Helens. He literally is part of the mountain. I remember him saying, I'm going to go down this mine shaft and I'll be all right. And geologists were telling him, no, you won't. And of course, he said, yes, he would. But what he was not prepared for was the following event. Mount St. Helens used to be 9,677 feet high. Today, it's 1,314 feet shorter at the peak with a much deeper crater besides. A piece of the top of that mountain, over 4 football fields thick and many miles wide, blew and buried everything for 20 miles straight north, while people, by the way, who were not far from the mountain on the south side didn't even recognize there had been an eruption. Lava flowing 80 miles an hour, wind blowing 300 miles an hour, and that staggering amount of ash came down the north slope and caught people like Harry S. Truman and buried them alive, probably after they were vaporized where they stood. The power of that explosion was 500 times the Hiroshima bomb. The amount of ash literally landed as far as 250 miles away on the city of Spokane, to the tune of 300 million pounds of ash just landed on Spokane, 250 miles away. Within 3 days, ash was over Washington, D.C., and within 15 days, ash was circling the globe. Hot avalanches of ash, pumice, and gas that reached 1,300 degrees poured down the mountain and hit and killed 57 people, including one famous geologist named David Johnston, who quick grabbed his phone and yelled, Vancouver, Vancouver, this is it. It was never heard from again, as were 55 other people, plus Harry Truman, who disappeared in his mountain lodge, never made it to the mine shaft. When Krakatoa blew up, I think, in 1836, you all remember the movie Krakatoa East of Java. Well, I'll never forget how embarrassed the producers were who produced that title. Krakatoa happens to be west of Java, but they'd already promoted the movie as Krakatoa East of Java, and not one person looked on a map to see that it's west of Java. So the movie entitled Krakatoa East should have been west of Java. was the story of Krakatoa Mountain that blew up, I think, in 1836. And it created what was called the Year of Always Winter. So much ash circled the globe from this one volcano that it snowed in northern Ohio every one of the 12 months. Most of you may not be familiar with that. Most of the Midwest received snow, at least a little, even in June, July, and August, and had a tremendously dense winter that year. It changed the ecology in a variety of ways, and it was one volcano halfway around the world. Now, I don't know whether you'd find that if you went east or west to get to Krakatoa from here, whether you wouldn't find that it's almost exactly the same trip either way. You couldn't hardly get further from Ohio going any direction on the globe than if you went to Krakatoa. And yet look at the impact that it had here. In northern New York, they had significant snow in July. One volcano can carry that much power. And I could go on and on in terms of what it did. 26,000 miles of roads in Washington State became impassable. When I was out there this last summer, first time I'd ever been to the Portland-Seattle area, we drove north up Highway 5 between Portland and Seattle, and I saw the one river there, I believe it's the Tuttle River, T-O-U-T-L-E, I may or Tuttle, I don't know how they pronounce it, and 20 miles of that river backed up with a tremendous amount of ash. I saw the ash that bulldozers had to push out of the river and dredge the river, because when the river backed up, and that thing blew up in May, and the snows were melting. It's the worst time of year for it to back up because the rivers were very full. It created tremendous flooding problems. They had to close the interstates. Bridges were blown out because this ash would build up, the water would build up behind it, and then blow it out, and then here would come this wall of water. Just tremendous, tremendous devastation occurred from that one destruction. Mount Lassen blew up in 1815. A lot of what's called the Ring of Fire, which circles the Pacific Ocean, of which the Cascade Mountains are a part, and Mount St. Helens is one of the most active parts, and frankly, I think about 10% of all the active volcanoes on Earth, considered active, are in the United States, but it's part of the Ring of Fire, and seismologists and geologists track those mountains. I believe St. Helens blew up in 1857 the last time, so it waited 123 years and did it again. Of course, you all are familiar with famous volcanoes in Mexico, and compared to some of the other volcanoes that went off, they were, as it's been said, a stick of dynamite. Mount St. Helens was a ladyfinger. You know what a ladyfinger is, a little tiny firecracker. Pompeii, vastly worse than Mount St. Helens, and the Ring of Fire has produced some devastating, devastating explosions. What would cause a man who was about, I believe about, let me just double check, I think he was something like 4 miles away, to think he could survive something like that in a mine shaft or any other way? It comes down to a verse that I read in a sermon a little while back, and I'm going to read it again by way of introducing a subject today, Proverbs 27 and verse 12. You'll recall I mentioned this proverb is in the Bible twice. A prudent man foresees the evil and hides himself. The simple pass on and are punished. Why would somebody stay there and think he could survive? He didn't plan to die on the mountain. He planned to survive it in the mine shaft. The answer is he was imprudent. He didn't foresee what even a ladyfinger-like volcanic explosion could do to somebody 5 miles away, when the reality is it killed a lot of people as much as 16 miles away. Caused tremendous problems for people who breathed in this hot ash. The ash immediately burnt the entirety of their lungs so that their lungs could no longer take in oxygen, and most of those 57 people died suffocating. They were not buried. They died a horrible, agonizing death. Now they'd been given about 70 days' notice that this was going to happen. They should have been able to foresee it, but they didn't. And maybe the better way to put it is that they wouldn't, as opposed to they didn't. Well, again, seismologists and geologists have said we sort of cut our teeth on Mount St. Helens because there's going to be other mountains that blow, that go, and there will clearly be things we can learn, and they did learn, and obviously there are even prophecies about how volcanic activity, some of it triggered by earthquakes or some of it which will trigger earthquakes, which, of course, Christ said will increase the time of the end. There are about 7 earthquakes every day on Earth that are measurable, sometimes more, sometimes less, and seismologists will tell you it has just ever so slowly been increasing for the last 25 years or so. Now, this room isn't shaking right now, so to believe that there are no earthquakes occurring, because we're not in one now, and I've been in 2, maybe I should say 3. I think there may have even been a 3rd one where, and it's not coming back to me where, but both times it was 6 in the morning that I can remember, but I have it in my head, I was in a 3rd one. And I'll tell you, I've seen one that was violent, one that was not very violent, and another one that I cannot recall, but I remember just sort of shaking very slightly. But because we don't feel it right now, that's sort of like saying, well, there's no rapes and murders occurring because I don't see one happening out on the street through the window there, but they are increasing. Now, all of that said, I always thought, moving away from physical prophesied events to trends now, I always thought things would be more suddenly worse in society. You must remember, I was supposed to be part of the last graduating class of Ambassador College. I truly believed that. I thought that maybe things were going to wrap up in 1972, January 7th. Many of us thought, most of the church, I think, beginning in about 1960 or 62, when it looked like that was the way the timetable was working out. We shouldn't have thought that way, but we did, and we grew out of it. We grew out of a lot of date setting. Mr. Armstrong grew out of certain trends he would think would take place in a certain number of years. They didn't, and we grew out of it. But I thought I was going to be part of the last graduating class from Ambassador College. Graduate in June of 1971, we'd be gone in 8 months, 7 months. And we'd be in the place of safety. I thought, along with those kinds of thoughts, that trends in society, prophesied events, both in people's conduct and in Europe, and maybe even volcanoes, earthquakes, pestilences, wars and rumors of wars, would much more suddenly get bad, get worse, and sort of, you know, just like that, we'd be through prophecy, we'd flee, and that would be that. About the mid-70s, I began to realize something struck me. By then I was a church pastor, and I was responsible for periodically preaching prophecy, at least more often, in full sermons. And it occurred to me, we're being given more warnings. As times get worse than I expected, things get much worse in society. Now remember, we're talking a quarter century ago. But they're also getting much worse more slowly than I expected. So I found that I was wrong, and the church learned slowly that we were wrong in 2 ways. Now, first there was the group of people that got mad at the church and said, they told me to do this, they told me we're going to flee, they told me this or that, things were going to wrap up. I read the booklet, 1975 in prophecy, and I took that as a final date, and I stopped repairing my car, I stopped fixing my teeth, I didn't put a new roof on my house. I heard it all. Many of you saw that. Well, I was in Ambassador College at that time. I wasn't married with children, so I didn't get into that type of thing. My teeth were fine at that point in my life, still pretty good. But I will say that some people chose to get mad. But other people said, wait a minute, there are a lot of verses about watching. We better do a better job of watching. Now, what have we done wrong? And 2 things struck me, and I'll repeat them again. I came to realize things were growing worse more slowly. That's the first thing where I saw we were wrong. My thinking had been wrong too. I didn't blame anybody. I bought into it. I'm not going to blame anybody over me because I chose to believe it. And number two, things got much worse more slowly than I ever expected. I began to see people do things and say things. And it moved into the 80s. And as I began to find myself pastoring first hundreds, then thousands, then many thousands of people through different transfers and watching people, I began to slowly realize, even in the church, most people never lived the book. Now, that's not what this sermon is about. But then I began to realize, too, people's conduct in the world was going to be and was becoming much worse than I ever expected. And I started studying why Christ said it would be as it was in the days of Noah. And then I went back and studied what it said about the days of Noah. Very little, but very bad. And then, as in Sodom and Gomorrah, it would be much the same. Went back and studied Sodom and Gomorrah. Didn't say a lot, said very little, but it was very bad. And I began to realize what we should have been looking for was always there in the Bible. Then I would have you turn to Matthew chapter 10. Matthew chapter 10. And I began to realize that this verse was here in the Scriptures. Much could be said about it. And I remember reading this Scripture in sermons. And we didn't hear a lot about this particular set of Scriptures, but I read it fairly often. And I began to realize a lot of things may not happen as we thought in terms of timing and in terms of intensity of how prophecies would be fulfilled. Slowly over course of time, after seeing the liberal years of the 70s, now many people would just change on a dime. If leaders said to do a certain thing a certain way, they would just change on a dime. I guess I wasn't quite as shocked then after Mr. Armstrong died that as soon as he was out of sight and out of mind and underground, I'm just being as blunt as most people viewed it, what's the next guy going to tell us to do? Because that's what we're going to do. And that they were literally worshiping Mr. Armstrong rather than the God who gave us the truth through him. And instead of respecting Mr. Armstrong, they worshiped him, which in its own terrible way, terribly disrespected Mr. Armstrong. So I began to realize everything was not as it seemed. Behold, verse 16, Matthew 10, I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. The first thing that struck me as I saw a lot of things in people's conduct, that was a verse talking to me. Now, I wasn't an apostle. That's not what I mean. But Christ was talking to senior ministers to be. They weren't yet, but they were going to be apostles. And he said, I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. We've talked about this before. Be you therefore wise as serpents and harmless as doves. Wise as serpents. Now, I don't know how wise serpents are, but you understand why Christ said that. There is something about a serpent that looks wise, or Eve never would have bought into something that changed her life and frankly ended her life, but changed her life forever. There's something about a serpent that looks wise. Now, most people recoil from snakes. I don't like snakes. People like snakes. I don't. I had one son who hated him, one son that loved him and pushed him in his face when he'd get him in his hands. And tell you which was which, but one son would come in, he'd have a garter snake in one pocket and a frog in the other, and then he'd pull him out and push him in his brother's face. And we had some exciting times, and the other brother, neither one of them ever changed. They just grew up. And they wouldn't want me to tell you which was which for different reasons. But I'll just say it was fun. I don't like snakes. My wife hates spiders. You know, there's certain things that people don't like. I don't know too many people that just say, oh, isn't that a wonderful spider? Now, I will be honest. And what a lovely cobra. So nobody really likes snakes. But there's something about serpents that look subtle, that look cunning, that look wise. They even hiss, you know, which is almost its own form of subtlety, I guess. But I began to realize, you know, this verse may mean me. I better be very careful. I might be sheep in the midst of wolves. If apostles could be, what about me? But beware of men, for they will deliver you up to the councils, and they will scourge you in their synagogues. We now know that every apostle, except John, died violently. You might think about that. And you should be brought before governors and kings for my sake, for a testimony against them and the Gentiles. But when they deliver you up, take no thought how or what you shall speak, for it shall be given you in that same hour what you shall speak. For it is not you that speak, but the Spirit of your Father which speaks in you. And brother shall deliver up the brother to death, and the father the child, and the children shall rise up against their parents, and shall cause them to be put to death. Now you might, as you're reading this, just ask yourself, do you believe this? I think the single greatest thing that I have learned through my years in the church, 34 years in the church, 30 years in about two more weeks, it'll be 30 years since I was first sent into the field, is I have found the biggest thing I need to do and I need to teach other people to do is look at exactly what the Bible says and believe it exactly as it says it. You want to just simplify everything. And frankly, if you want to simplify Herbert Armstrong's life, there are two things that defined and drove that man in a way that I've never seen in any other human being. Number one, he feared God, and number two, he believed God. It wasn't perfect, but neither has any other servant of God been perfect. You shall be hated of all men for my name's sake, but he that endures to the end shall be saved. But when they persecute you in this city, flee you into another. For verily I say unto you, you shall not have gone over the cities of Israel till the Son of Man be come. That's quite a picture of what it will be like all the way till the Son of Man come. That's really advice starting in verse 16, not just for people back then, because the apostles weren't going to be around when the Son of Man comes. We are. And you're going to have to be really savvy to survive. Frankly, we're going to have to do better than Harry S. Truman or a lot of other people. Because things are going to get much worse for a much longer period of time. And I remember saying those exact words, reading from my notes, that exact set of instructions. In 1980, when I stood up the week after Harry Truman was killed and gave a sermon that started out exactly as I just introduced it then, those were words, up to this point in the sermon, that were exactly the way I introduced a sermon on the first Sabbath in May after Mount St. Helens blew up. So for 20 years, I can honestly say, because I have the notes to prove it, that it's occurred to me that would be the way it was. James chapter 3. James chapter 3 and verse 13. Who is a wise man and endued with knowledge among you? Let him show out of good conduct his works with meekness of wisdom. With meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter envying and strife in your hearts, glory not and lie not against the truth. And that's where lies always start against God's truth. They start in the heart. This wisdom, that's an interesting statement. This wisdom, it doesn't say this non-wisdom. This wisdom, it's a type of wisdom. Descends not from above, but is earthly, sensual, and devilish. Now we're going to talk more about that wisdom. You're going to see why some people have it, why some people don't have it, why some people once had it and can grow out of it. Through scriptures we're going to look at. For where envying and strife is, there is confusion in every evil work. That's quite a statement. Where you have envying and strife, that's arguing, you have absolutely everything that can go wrong. God is not the author of confusion, but of peace, as in all churches of the saints. So when the God of confusion, not the true God of the Bible, but the God of this world, the God of confusion is involved, is it strange then that you would have every kind of evil work? No, it is not. But it's tied into this thing called this wisdom, which is described as earthly. It's physical. It's sensual. That means it comes from the senses. It doesn't come from above. And it's devilish. Now, there is a devilish wisdom. That's why it says the serpent was more subtle than any other beast of the field. Verse 17. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, not confusion. Gentle and easy to be entreated, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. And the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace of them that make peace. That's why one of the Beatitudes, the beautiful attitudes as it's called, is blessed are the peacemakers. Often said, you can't go in and make peace where there's already peace. It's not blessed are the peaceful. There are a lot of people that are fairly peaceful, placid, low-key personalities. A peacemaker is somebody who can make peace where there isn't peace. You can't make peace where there's already peace. You can only make peace, and that's an extraordinary ability that springs from wisdom. That's why the ability to make peace is one of the core elements of real wisdom. And God says they will have a very special reward. Now let's turn to 2 Timothy chapter 3. 2 Timothy 3, a verse we often read. All of us, spiritually speaking, live at the foot of Mount St. Helens. You may have never thought of it that way, but you and I do. We do. We really do, brethren. We live at the foot of Mount St. Helens. We live in times that are dangerous. We don't live in the shadow of an actual physical mountain that's dangerous. We live in something that's really much more dangerous in many ways. This know also that in the last days, dangerous, perilous times shall come. I was reading this in the 26 translations. There's so many different ways that you could reread these next approximately 4 or 5 verses. Men shall be lovers of their own selves. Now, that's interesting. Well, you say, what's so dangerous about that? Well, if somebody loves themselves, they don't care about you. They don't care about you. Now, no man yet ever hated his own flesh, and we should love others as we love ourselves. But if people only love themselves, then they don't care about you or what happens to you, and that leads to certain kinds of conduct that could hurt you. Covetous, boasters, they're braggarts, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, without natural affection, just sick people, sick. Truce breakers, they break their word, and they make war. A truce breaker declares a truce and then violates it. I don't know how many times you'll hear of wars down through history. If you've studied wars, there were truces, then they were broken, or truces, and then finally you have actual peace, which is long after you start declaring a truce. And somebody will fire a shot and the truce is broken, then you have to calm it down again. The Middle East has been a long history of truce breaking. False accusers. We live in the age when there's false accusation everywhere. The accuser of the brethren's always been around, but in the last days there's a lot more of it. Incontinent, fierce, despisers of those that are good. Now that's a sobering verse. We're going to look at another one in a moment. Despisers of those that are good. Now, what they do as a result of despising them, we'll find in another verse. Traitors, heady, just headstrong, full of themselves, you can just tell it. High-minded, lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God. I mean, watch this society. I marvel at how many people jam. I go to the movies and I don't even like to go anymore. The entire parking lot. You know, every so often I'll go into a movie theater. If I watch a movie, I'll usually rent one or watch it at home. But every so often I go to a movie. And you pull into the parking lot of some of these movie theaters, and the cars now just are further and further and further away from the actual movie theater itself. You have a longer walk, just a longer physical walk to get up there, and the lines are longer. And I've watched it. I've been alive long enough now in my 50s that I guess I can just see the trend as people want pleasure. You stand in a line at Cedar Point or Disney World, and you will hear the same thing. The traffic is just maddening. The parking lots are further away. More and more waits. You know, if you go into Disney World 20 years ago and you go up to a certain ride, it'll say at the top, a 1-hour and 15-minute wait. You know, if you come earlier in the morning, the waits might say 20 minutes. Come later in the day, it might be 2 hours. Then real late, then all of a sudden you can ride the same ride over and over again. Run right down the ride, get in line and go again, but you have to wait till 11 o'clock at night. It's been many, many years. I think 1988, the last time we took our kids to Disney World. And I concluded that if I ever go again, I'm going at 2 in the morning. And that's when we can just ride the rides. Because people are there, they say, well, you were there. Well, yes, I was. But I'm trying to illustrate a point that people, there are more and more people jamming these places. More and more people just out on the beach or doing things, playing games, going to places where they'll pay tremendous amounts of money. Now, you can't get more people into Cleveland Stadium, Jacobs Field. Can't get more people, 43,500 or 42,500. But I'll tell you now how you find out that people love pleasure more than they did. You can't look at the attendance and see the attendance going up because it's been sold out every game for years, 5-6 years. They just charge more for the tickets. And people will keep paying more for the tickets, so they must love the pleasure of being there more because they'll pay for the tickets. Now, in basketball, they'll outprice it. They're outpricing themselves. And now corporations are the only people that can buy tickets. As one coach said, though, he said, I used to coach 12 basketball players. Now these guys are paid so much money. He said, now I coach 12 corporations. And I start 5 corporations and 7 corporations sit on the bench. That's what he said, because these guys, they have their investment advisors and their agents and they're talking on their cell phones during meetings. And, I mean, the whole world is changing. Remember, Magic Johnson walked over, grabbed a cell phone. He only coached for about 2 months, and he said he couldn't stand it anymore, and that was in the early 90s. He said he couldn't stand it anymore because nobody would ever listen to the coach, because now the players can get the coach fired instead of the coach can cut the player. People love pleasures, and because the players are gods in this society, and the people sitting in the stands view them as gods, woe be to the coach who doesn't let the players run the team so that people can sit there like the Colosseum in Rome and have their pleasures. Now, strangely enough, in this same society, unlike 20, 25 years ago, more and more people are going to church. Or they're getting their religion online, or there's 7 new books on religion published every day in this country. That's hundreds a year. So they have a form of godliness, but they deny the power thereof. From such turn away. Isaiah 59 and verse 15. Isaiah 59 and verse 15. Back to despisers of those that are good. Notice this verse, a warning to all of us. Yes, truth fails, and he that departs from evil, that's a good person, a godly person, makes himself a prey. Could also be translated as accounted mad, but he makes himself a prey. A prey is somebody that a predator stalks. People who don't go along with the crowd are literally targets. And the Lord saw it, and it displeased him that there was no judgment. Matthew 24 and verse 15. Matthew 24 and verse 15. It's not a sermon about this subject, but it wouldn't be a complete sermon. We're going into the subject of wisdom. It wouldn't be a complete sermon on the subject if you didn't at least allude to, if I didn't allude to, this verse. When you shall therefore see the abomination, Matthew 24, 15, spoken of by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place, whoso reads, let him understand. Now that's a little different from the verse where Christ is quoting it. If you jump back to Daniel chapter 12, you see it's written a little differently. Christ quoted in principle this verse, Daniel 12:10, many shall be purified, made white and tried. But the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand. Whoso reads, let him understand. The wise understand. A little different. And he was referring, of course, to Daniel. Now, the wise understand, brethren, what is going on. Imprudent people who cannot foresee the evil, because they have fallen into perhaps a my Lord delays his coming attitude, will not understand. They will not know that they're sitting in a shadow, the shadow of a world that is going to blow. And when it does, it'll spread as fast as that ash that circled the globe in 15 days and dumped as much as 300 million pounds, that's 150,000 tons of ash, on places like Spokane, 250 miles away. And that was a little firecracker. We live in the shadow of a world that's going to blow. And you have a choice. You can be one of the wise that understands, or you can not foresee the evil and choose to be a Harry S. Truman. Turn to 1 Kings chapter 3. 1 Kings chapter 3. What would you do if you were in this situation? Now, you need to ask yourself this, because there's lots of movies about what people do when they're given a choice, given three wishes. What would you do if you were told you could make a wish and have it? First Kings 3, verse 5. In Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night, and God said, "Ask what I shall give you." Which of us wouldn't want God as the ultimate genie? God's not a genie, but you know what I mean. You know the stories of genies. You can make three wishes. Abracadabra, you know, and you get, what was that? I guess that's where the, or open, no, that was Open Sesame. Abracadabra was a genie. Anyway, make a wish. It was once a program, I Dream of Genie. Ask what I shall give you. What do you want? Make a wish. And Solomon said, "You have showed unto your servant David, my father, great mercy, according as he walked before you in truth and in righteousness and in uprightness of heart with you. And you have kept for him this great kindness that you have given him a son to sit on his throne as it is this day." Now this is Solomon responding. And I'll tell you, I've thought about what we're about to read many, many times, because my mother, every single time we ate, I think it was chicken, always, always saved the wishbone and gave it to two of us, and we made a wish. My whole childhood, she always saved the wishbone. Remember the wishbone? You'd pull on. I could tell the wishbone was always crooked. It was crooked. And one side was weaker than the other, and we were the three children, so the first battle was which one doesn't get to hold on to the wishbone, and we'd usually draw straws before we would get to hold, be the two that of the three that held the wishbone, and one, the loser, that didn't get to do it, and then we'd make a wish, and it wouldn't make any difference, because I could always tell who was going to win. But you could see that one side was stronger than the other, so we would test and pull real fast, see if that would make the stronger side break. It didn't. But we would do it and have fun because, you know, my mother made a game out of making a wish. I don't ever remember getting anything I wished for, but I probably had the weak side of the wishbone. "And now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king instead of David my father, and I am but a little child. I know not how to go out or come in." You know what we would say? We don't know up from down. Solomon said, "I don't know how to go out or come in. And your servant is in the midst of your people, which you have chosen, a great people that cannot be numbered nor counted for multitude. Give therefore your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, that I may discern between good and bad. For who is able to judge this your so great a people? Please give me understanding." I remember, brethren, I've probably said this before, Mr. Armstrong said it, so I got it from him, and I'm not embarrassed, and I'll just say it bluntly. I read that when I was 17 years old, and I heard Mr. Armstrong say he prayed for understanding, and so I began to pray for understanding, and I did it every single day for 15 years. I do not believe I missed a day. I had it at the top of my prayer list because this story struck me as one of the first things I read when I started actually studying my Bible. Every time I ever read my Bible, I got to Genesis 4 and died of boredom when I was a Presbyterian. And now all of a sudden the Bible was interesting, and I read about Solomon and heard Mr. Armstrong say he prayed for understanding. So I thought, well, if he can do it, I'll do it. Well, the speech pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked this thing, and God said to him, "Because you have asked this thing, and have not asked for yourself long life, neither have asked riches for yourself," that's what usually you see for the three wishes, "nor have asked the life of your enemies, God kill so-and-so, but have asked for yourself understanding to discern judgment, behold, I have done according to your words. Lo, I have given you a wise," now there you see a different word, "a wise and an understanding heart," two separate words, "so that there was none like you before you, neither after you shall any arise like unto you." You could add "ever again." "And I have also given you that which you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that there shall not be any among the kings like unto you all your days. If you will walk in my ways to keep my statutes and my commandments as your father David did walk, then I will lengthen your days also." You didn't ask for a long life. He said, "Now I'll also give you that," but that's got a contingency tied to it. And Solomon awoke, and behold, it was a dream, and he came to Jerusalem and stood before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord and offered up burnt offerings and peace offerings and made a feast to all his servants. And then came the famous test with the two women and the baby. And he said, divide the baby as the best way of saving it and finding out who the mother was. So God wanted to immediately validate in his mind and to everyone around this extraordinary wisdom that had been given to Solomon immediately. And he did. Solomon made a wise choice, you might say, in asking for wisdom. And the rest of that story you can read about those women. Chapter 4 and verse 29. And God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding exceeding much and largeness of heart. Now, I suspect that one of the reasons he received largeness of heart is David prayed in Psalm 119 that God would give him largeness of heart. We would say today, big-mindedness. You know, you see a lot of petty people. They're penny-anny. They just think small. I can't stand them. Can't, but you've seen them. They're hard to deal with. People who think big, who are big-hearted. You say, boy, what a big-hearted guy. Well, you're talking about largeness of heart. Even as the sand that is on the seashore. Well, go to the seashore sometime to appreciate that statement. Now, and Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the children of the East Country and all the wisdom of Egypt, for he was wiser than all men, than Ethan the Ezrahite and Haman and Calcol and Darda, the sons of Mahal. And his fame was in all nations round about. Those men, Ethan, Haman, Calcol, Darda, who were sons of Mahal, were all descendants of Judah. Very wise men. They did not have God's Spirit, but they had a certain wisdom. And he spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. He spoke 3,000 proverbs. Now, I decided one day to count the number of proverbs, and you'll find there's about 900 proverbs that he wrote. Now, some of them could be split into two, but a lot of them, several verses, you could say equals one proverb. He spoke from memory 3,000 proverbs, and he could sing 1,005 songs. Think of the incredible just memory, the gift of memory that he had. I mean, if I hear a song from the past, I can sort of sing along with some of it, and, you know, I can remember it, but I sure don't get anywhere near 1,005, and that's if you just counted parts of them. I doubt I could get anywhere remotely near that, and I have a decent memory and like to sing songs when I hear them on the radio. They're the right kind of songs and so forth. And he spoke of trees from the cedar of from the cedar tree that is in Lebanon. He spoke of trees. That's interesting. A lot you can learn from trees. A lot in the Bible about trees. I remember reading this, and I started studying trees. I've loved to study trees as a result of this. Because God could have said, you know, he spoke about deep things. He spoke about tremendously broad, big-minded things. Well, what would that be? You'd wonder, what would he speak of? He had all these proverbs, and it says he spoke of trees. What? He spoke of trees? I thought the guy had wisdom. There's lots of wisdom you can learn. Would you say you could learn wisdom from trees? From the cedar tree that's in Lebanon, either the hyssop that springs out of the wall. He spoke of beasts. As I recall, he said, go to the ant. Did he not? He said there are things that are too wonderful for him. The way of an eagle in the air. The way of a snake on a rock. He must have watched a snake on a rock and watched an eagle in the air. Fishes, creeping things. Maybe that's where he studied ants. And he said, go to the ant. It was what we read a week ago. A remarkable gift of wisdom, and he could learn from practical things around him. He was very practical. And there came of all people to hear the wisdom of Solomon from all kings of the earth which had heard of his wisdom. His wisdom got around, as we talked about in the sermon, I think maybe it was 2 weeks ago. Now let's go back and ask, would you have asked for wisdom? You could say, yeah, I would have. Well, the reality is, only one person's ever been asked the question. That was Solomon. He gave a wonderful answer. And if you go by the stories I've read about people when they have wishes, I'll use myself. I never asked for wisdom when I pulled on that wishbone or blew out my birthday candles. You know, make a wish and then you try to blow them all out. You know what, all those things we did that are pagan and superstitious and wrong, but wishes were involved. I'll just be honest with you, as we always are supposed to keep our wish inside. My mother said, don't ever tell anybody you're weird, so I kept it inside. Well, I'll tell you right now, I'll let it out. I never asked for wisdom as a little kid. I don't remember what I did ask for, but I didn't ask for wisdom. Now, just think about all of the Proverbs and the wisdom that this man could apply, 3,000 of them. We went into a situation, and 3,000 different ideas popping through his head. He didn't study the Bible. You've heard me say this before, but it's true. I read that verse one time, and I said, you know what? I'm going to try to practice studying the Bible without my Bible. So probably half the time I study my Bible, I try to do it without my Bible in my hand. I literally will call verses to mind. I'll pick a subject, and then I'll just study through it to just see if I can bring them to mind. It's just an exercise I enjoy doing. It's stimulating, and it helps me. And it helps me automatically in situations bring verses to mind. You might try it. Just practice it. I'm not saying it's any gift. It's just something I decided to do because I saw Solomon could do it with 3,000 Proverbs, and I'm sure God gave him that gift. And 1,005 songs. Interesting. It wasn't 1,000. It was 1,005. So somebody actually counted them up. I mean, that number is accurate. You know, brethren, when Solomon speaks, we should listen. And I want to ask you a question. If you bought a house anywhere, most of you have, and you were told shortly after you moved into that house, you know, you hear about your neighbors. I learned about my neighbors. We've moved many times, and sometimes we've had nice neighbors, sometimes not so nice neighbors. You learn about them, and you hope they're okay and this and that. But what if you were told? What if you were told that right next door to you, it just so happened, right next door to this home you had purchased and moved into, the wisest man on the face of the earth lived. He was right next door. And that furthermore, he was available, he was accessible, he was retired. Anytime you faced any tough decision, this person who had this incredible wisdom, not earthly, sensual, and devilish wisdom, but literally the wisdom of God, you could ask him anything and he was over there, he was relaxing, he was sitting out in his backyard, and happy to have the neighbors drop in, and he would talk to you just as freely as you would wish him to. What would you do? What would you do? There he is. You just lucked out and you bought the house right next door to the wisest man in the history of the world, past, present, or future. Or let's put it another way. What if Solomon lived right next door to you? And he was absolutely available. And you could tell him, you know, somebody took my kid. That's my baby. And you could walk over there and you just get the right answer. Whatever it was. Something wrong with your trees or whatever it might be. Your dog's bad. Something wrong with the dog. What do I do? My marriage is in trouble. I've got trouble with my kids. I need financial advice. You could just go to him. I have news for you, brethren. You can. Only you don't have to walk next door. And you don't even have to take a pad and paper with you to write down what he says because you've got it right here. You literally do. Now, I brought it up that way because most people say, I'd be over there every day. I mean, every time I was going to do something, if I was going to buy a car, if I was going to decide whether to have, you know, 3 children or 14, you know, I'd go talk with him. See, if we're going to change jobs, I would get counsel from this wise man. Would you? Would you really? Because how often do you pick up the words that he recorded for you that are the very best of his wisdom on every subject we just named and many more? You know, brethren, when Solomon speaks, we should listen. Someday, Ethan, Haman, Calcol, and Darda will all listen to him. Turn to Ecclesiastes 8. Ecclesiastes 8. Let's look at an example of his wisdom. I remember I was just stunned when I read this for the first time. I've never forgotten it. Some of you have heard me quote it to you. It just stunned me. Ecclesiastes 8:4. Where the word of the king is, there is power, and who may say unto him, what do you? Hey, what are you doing? He's the king. He can do anything he wants. Nobody says, what are you doing to the king? Now, the king says to other people, what are you doing? But who's going to say to the king, what do you do? Whoso keeps the commandment shall feel no evil thing. And a wise man's heart discerns both time and judgment. Why? Because verse 6, to every purpose There is time and judgment. Therefore, the misery of man is great upon him. Now, a wise man understands he better discern both time and judgment. Why? Because every purpose has both elements. Now, very briefly, we've talked about this before. Maybe it's been a long time. But some people know what to do. They can make the right judgment, don't know when to do it. They can't get the timing right. Other people know something's got to be done. The timing is there, but they don't know what to do. Some people know what to do and when to do and don't do it. Some people don't know what to do or when to do it. And then the fifth category are the people that know what to do and when to do it, and they do it. Every purpose you face both elements. Now stop and think. How important is that? Well, apparently it's so important that people who disregard it find their misery is great through their lifetime because they don't discern. They need to know what to do and when to do it. Now, God wouldn't say that you should be a wise person who discerns that if you couldn't be a wise person who discerns the what and the when of every purpose you will ever face. Then he says, see, but you can't do it, and therefore you're going to be miserable, and there's not going to be anything you can do about it. No, God wants us to be able to know what to do and when to do it so that our misery is not great. Now, just stop for a moment before we talk about, or before we go any further about the specifics of that statement. Think about the wisdom you just read right there. You'd know anybody else who would talk like that? That's just one example. We read from Solomon. And, of course, now we're reading from Ecclesiastes, which Solomon wrote. And that's stunning wisdom. That's just absolutely stunning. Look at Ecclesiastes 3 and verse 1. To everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under the heaven. Was it Peter, Paul, and Mary who sang that song? I forget who that was. I don't remember. None of you know Peter, Paul, and Mary? Was it Turn, the song? I can't remember. Yeah. I like that. In the 60s, it came out. There is a time to every purpose under the heaven. A time to be born, time to die, time to plant, time to pluck up. Time to kill, time to heal, time to break down, and so forth. So there's no question there's a time for everything, but then what do you do? Because this discusses the time and what to do. You have to know when the time to cast away stones comes, as opposed to the time to gather stones, to embrace and to refrain from embracing. A time to get, that's to seek, time to lose. Time to keep and cast away. Sometimes those are beyond your control. You could lose a child. You could lose a home, lose a job. That's beyond your control sometimes. Sometimes there's a time to just give something up by choice. So the what and the when is sort of described there. A time to rend. I've learned I can wear my T-shirts only so many times, and then you put them on, and they are absolutely the holiest T-shirts you ever saw in your life. And I you know what I do? So that I never wear them again, I make sure they don't go into the wash. I rip them up. That's my T-shirts all die the same way, torn to pieces and thrown into the waste basket. So I have learned that's true. There is a time to rend. And if it's a rent that I don't want, I have learned there's a time to sew, and I go to my wife. And she's willing to be a so-and-so and so. But anyway, time to keep silent, a time to speak, and so forth. My wife needs this sermon. She had her wisdom teeth pulled this week, so she's feeling a little short of wisdom. And I'm sorry, honey, I couldn't help it. It just came out. Proverbs 14 and verse 17. I know, that was pitiful. The tape out there never picks up the laughs, like I said last week. They never pick up the laughs. For all of you out there, the people are roaring with laughter here, and I know it's not being picked up on the tape. Take my word for it. Proverbs 14 and verse 17. He that is soon angry deals foolishly, and a man of wicked devices is hated. Now, would you think of that? That verse, I just pick it right out of the blue. It's not a sermon about anger. It's not a sermon about wicked devices. Those are proverbs from the wisest man who ever lived, and you can read them anytime you want. He's not next door. He's right over on the coffee table as part of the most popular book ever printed in the history of the world, yet perhaps, as Mr. Armstrong used to say, the least read and gathering the most dust, because people don't pick it up. Maybe it's not quite as engaging to read what Solomon said instead of hear him say it and watch him gesture and turn to you and give you his personal attention. But you know, how easy is it? It's just so easy. A man of wicked devices is hated. Would you have thought of that? That's an example of one of Solomon's 3,000 proverbs. People who are hot-headed, go kill people. Road rage is a direct byproduct of people who no longer care about, probably never did, read Proverbs 14:17. He that's soon angry deals foolishly. People who are soon angry often pick up a weapon and kill people they love. 72% of all murders are committed between people who know each other, who, if they had been just cooler, just stayed cool, wouldn't have done it. A great many murders in this country are nothing more than lovers' quarrels that they would have been fine if they had just waited. I decided one time to go all the way through my Bible and color in orange. I don't know why I picked orange, but I did. All of the verses about wisdom and tact and discretion and so forth, just go all the way through and color them in. And every so often, I'll just pick up the Proverbs and read everything in orange. I have things in other colors as well. Things about wrath I have in blue. Sometimes I'll read through on that subject and so forth. But, you know, you can study those subjects. What subject do you find you're lacking? Are you a person who always finds yourself, I put my foot in it again? Is that you? Then study all the verses about how not to put your foot in it. Maybe it just means not saying anything. Not saying anything. I'll tell you, I have put my foot in it by saying things so many times that unfortunately I became an example of what Mr. Armstrong meant when he said experience is not the best teacher, but it's a good one. You just speak too fast. I've spoken too fast. You have too. And you just say something that can make a person feel bad. You just, why did they say that? I didn't mean to say it that way. And you just said it in a way and they feel bad. Acts 19. Why do you suppose this happened? Acts 19 and verse 10. Acts 19 and verse 10. Excuse me. And this continued, Acts 19:10, by the space of 2 years, so that all which dwelt in Asia heard the word of the Lord Jesus, both Jews and Greeks. And God wrought special miracles by the hands of Paul, so that from his body were brought unto the sick handkerchiefs or aprons. You wonder where the concept of anointed cloths comes from? Anointed handkerchiefs or aprons? Who knows where they got the cloth? Maybe they just tore a little something off. God inspired Paul to do something no one had ever done before. Maybe tear a little piece of a handkerchief off or a little piece of an apron and anoint it, because he came to realize he couldn't get to certain places. And the diseases departed from them and the evil spirits went out of them. Well, some people looked at that and said, wow, that's exciting. Demons do what he says. Then certain of the vagabond Jews, now that means, you look in the Greek, vagabond Jews, it means to stroll, to wander about like gypsies. These people were gypsy-like. Also means to vacillate. They just went back and forth in their lifestyle. You know, people vacillate in their mind. They vacillated all through life. They wandered around. The Greek word means to stroll, to wander about, to be like a gypsy, to vacillate. So then certain of those type of Jews, exorcists, took upon them to call over them which had evil spirits the name of the Lord Jesus, saying, we adjure you by Jesus whom Paul preaches. They didn't say, we adjure you in the name of Jesus Christ. They thought, well, we'll throw in Paul, because we don't have Paul's authority, but if we throw in Paul, maybe that gives us his authority. So there's error number one. A true minister of God never calls in the authority of anybody else. He just, by the authority of Christ. And there were seven sons of one Siva, a Jew, and a chief of the priests, which did so. And the evil spirit, now this is one demon, answered and said, Jesus I know, and Paul I know, but who are you? And the man in whom the evil spirit was leapt on them, overcame them, and prevailed against them, so that they fled out of that house naked and wounded. Now, if you say to yourself, I don't know how one human being could strip seven guys naked, the answer is, he couldn't. But a demon could. What's the point? Here's the point. Why did they do that? Why did seven people go into that situation? Seven men took on one guy, and before any of them could even get out. I mean, how does he do this? He holds six while he strips one, then throws him aside, then holds the other five while he strips one. How do you do that? I'm not sure I'd exactly want to see, but it is interesting that the scriptures showed that he did it. Did he lock the door, stand in front of the door? What did he do? But the bigger question, of course, is how could it happen? The answer is you had seven very foolish people who had no idea they were walking into tremendous danger. Because they weren't just stripped, they were wounded. They got hurt. Now, having seen the power of demons, I have learned you had better have the authority of Jesus Christ. You've heard me mention this before. If one demon can overcome seven people, I'm telling you, I have faced seven demons by myself. I've done it. And I've cast them out. Only did that one time. Six of them left and one went later. And I'll tell you what, I didn't go in there because I thought, I'm 6'7", they will not mess with me. Because I've watched them. I've watched them become profoundly strong and do almost unbelievable superhuman things. So a little wisdom would have saved those guys a lot of embarrassment. Now, I don't know. The count doesn't tell you how many people saw seven streakers running home, presumably in seven different directions. They were, I'm sure, adults. But that's what happened. 1 Corinthians 1 and verse 26. 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 26. For you see your calling, brethren, how that not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty and many noble are called. Brethren, do you see that? You know, when we first come into the church, we look around. This is what we all do. Come on, let's be honest. We do. We look around and we say, wow, that's right. There aren't many of us who are wise here. There's only a few of us. And then in time, you recognize, wait a minute, it means me too. It means me too. Not many wise. And even then, what kind of wisdom? Not many mighty, not many noble are called, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world. Now, I'm going to ask you before we finish this sermon with a few other verses. Do you believe that God chose you as one of the foolish things of the world to be able to, as it goes on, confound the wise? I'm not sure a group of fishermen were the wisest people on the face of the earth, and yet they were told, be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. Solomon didn't start out the wisest man who ever lived. If he had, he wouldn't have asked for it. He just ended up that way. You might think about that. Read that verse often, and I'll ask you, do you see your calling? Do you think God looked down and said, now, look at so-and-so, I just have to have them. What will I do? How will my church function if I don't have them? And there's another one. And there's another one. And do you think that's how God calls people? Sometime I'll give a sermon, because there's a staggering amount of material in those few verses about how God calls people, how he foreknows them, and what that means. Because when God calls you, that's phase three of his plan to work with you. I can prove that biblically. It's the first time you know he's dealing with you, but it's already phase three of God's plan to work with you. Sorry, I'll have to leave you with that. We'll talk some other time about it. But do you see your calling? Do you recognize that you are foolish? Look at Romans 1. Turn back to Romans 1 from 1 Corinthians 1. Verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness. It's actually hold back or suppress the truth. There are people who do that. They know the truth and they hold it back. They suppress it in unrighteousness. They have a reason to not let the truth get out. Because that which may be known of God is manifest. It's absolutely manifest. It says in them, it should be to them. If you look in the margin, the Greek is to them. What can be known about God's truth is manifest, brethren, for God has showed it to them. For the invisible things of Him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. You know why Solomon could talk about creeping things and fishes and trees and beasts? Because he knew he could learn a tremendous amount about God by looking at the things that were visible. He could learn about the invisible by looking at the things that are seen. And God is manifest. There's a tremendous amount of wisdom you can gain by just looking at the things that the mind of God created. I've followed a pattern. My wife will tell you this. Every single day where it's reasonable, I walk through my yard. I just do. It usually takes 5 to 15 minutes I spend in my yard. I just go out there, particularly on the Sabbath. I enjoy doing it. I just look at leaves. I think about them. I stand in the shade. You know, I just love to do that. I don't go pruning. Don't go digging or planting or anything like that. But the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. And so I go right out there and I honor, you know, the part of the principle of the Sabbath. I want to give a sermon on how to keep the Sabbath, where the Sabbath reflects creation. So I do that. But I try to do it every day. If it's not pouring rain or, you know, snow or whatever, I certainly don't then. Verse 21, because that when they knew God, they glorified Him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. How did that happen? Here's how it happened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. Now, if you think you're wise, if you do not see your calling, that God has called you as one of the foolish things of the world to confound the wise, you will never get on the road, brethren, I promise you, to being wise. You will never walk next door and talk to the wisest man who ever lived, or if you do, you won't follow what he says. So then what does a Christian do? Go right back to 1 Corinthians, this time chapter 3, verse 18. Let no man deceive himself. 1 Corinthians 3:18. If any man among you seems to be wise in this world, remember we talked about worldly wisdom, earthly, sensual, and devilish, let him become a fool that he may be wise. Now what we read in Romans 1, when people do not look to God, they reject God, they profess themselves to be wise and become fools. The Christian sees his calling that he's a fool, let him become a fool. Now God doesn't say, go out and be a fool. No, it's acknowledge that you're a fool and you've started down the road to being wise. For the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God, for it is written, He takes the wise in their own craftiness. And again, the Lord knows the thoughts of the wise, that they are vain. That's the worldly wise. The Jonadabs of the world. You might go read about Jonadab in 2 Samuel 23. It says he was subtle. You look up the Hebrew word for Jonadab back there. Skillful, artful, cunning, subtle, wise, but worldly wise. Therefore, let no man glory in men. Don't glory in Solomon. Glory in the Spirit of God that's in Solomon. I've watched, brethren, down through the years, and I've heard sermons and done it myself. I've watched, brethren, do things that prove we are the foolish. We are, brethren. I look at some of the ways I've done things in my life. Why did I buy that? I think, why did I go out and buy that? That was one of the dumbest things. What did I think I needed that tool for? Or just other decisions that I've made. You've made foolish decisions. You've wasted money. Made decisions that cost you time. And so forth. Why do people come into the church, turn right around and push their relatives with the truth? Try to sell them. Just jam it down their throat. Why do they do that? Well, they're zealous. That's fine. That's good. But they're unwise. I've watched brethren go into business together. Oh, I'm telling you. Watch my father-in-law learn some bitter lessons. He would try to help people, and then he got burnt. Years later in his life, he was much wiser. Mr. Armstrong trusted certain people. Oh, how it, he, later on he rued the day and said so, and said so, and realized he'd made terrible mistakes. Look at Luke 16. Are you growing in wisdom, brethren? We're going to conclude with some quick tips on how to do it. Luke 16 and verse 8. The parable of the unjust steward, verse 5, he called every one of his Lord's debtors. You know, he was supposed to give an account of his stewardship. And said to the first, how much owe you unto my Lord? And he said, 100 measures of oil. And he said unto him, take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. Then said he to another, and how much owe you? And he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said to him, take your bill and write 80. Well, instead of 200 measures, he now has 130. That's not bad. The Lord commended the unjust steward, he'd been a poor steward, because he'd done wisely. For the children of this world are in their generation wiser than the children of light. Do you believe Jesus Christ when he says just the worldly wisdom of people in the world exceeds the wisdom that we're supposed to get from God in the church? Those who are children of light. Do you believe that verse? Do you, have you professed yourself to be a fool? Have you said, I see my calling and I am one of the foolish things of the world. And if I'm ever going to confound the wise and be used by God to confound the wise, I have to admit, I don't know how to go out or come in. I don't know up from down. Or do you profess yourself to be wise? Because if you do, you think, hey, I'm a savvy guy. I'm a pretty moxie guy. You know, I know what, I'm a sharp lady. You know what? You'll remain a fool. You'll remain a fool. There are six words for wisdom in the Hebrew. Study them. Study them. Study Yul, Kasil, Nabal, Kakal, Shakal, and Sikal. What are those? Go study them. You know, when you read the subject of wisdom, there's six different kinds of true wisdom. Go read them. I'm sorry, those are the four words for fool. The six words for wisdom, let me correct it. I had the last two right. I was reading off the wrong list. Chokmah, Bina, Leb, Arma, and Sakal, and Sekel. Sakal and Sekel are the six for wisdom and four for fool. Yul, Kesil, Nabal. Was it Abigail was married to Nabal? That was his name, Fool. Anybody said, hey, Fool, you know, that was his name. And Kakal. And each one of those different types of foolishness. Study examples of them. I decided to look up examples of all six types of wisdom and all four types of foolishness just to study them and see the difference. You got 10 words. There'd be a fascinating Bible study sometime. Proverbs 1. A wise man will hear and will increase learning, and a man of understanding shall attain unto wise counsels. To understand the proverb in the interpretation, the words of the wise and their dark sayings, their deep sayings. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. And over, you'll find, my son, hear the instruction of your father, verse 8. My son, you turn all the way through, chapter 2, my son. This is a dad talking to his son. A son who didn't do a very good job of listening to his father. Here are some ways you gain wisdom. Do them very quickly. Number one, pray for wisdom. I'll just cite the verse. James 1, 5 to 7. Do any of you lack wisdom? Let him ask of God, who gives to all men liberally and upbraids not. But ask in faith. You know, don't waver. The man that wavers is like a wave of the sea. Let not that man think that he shall receive anything. You know, a double-minded man's unstable in all his ways. That's a pretty close paraphrase. I'm not turning there. Pray for wisdom. Just pray for wisdom. That's number one. Just ask God every day for wisdom. You can't very well be wise as a serpent and harmless as a dove if you've only done the harmless part. You've got to be wise as a serpent. Proverbs 12 and verse 15, listen to counsel. Proverbs 12 and verse 15, listen to counsel. The way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but he that listens to counsel is wise. Listen to counsel. Number three, exercise wisdom. Exercise it. Ecclesiastes 7. Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 11. Wisdom is good with an inheritance, but by it there is profit to them that see the sun. Now that's interesting. Wisdom is good with an inheritance. Now some will say it's as good as an inheritance, other translations, and that may be true too, but it's actually a lot better than an inheritance. I don't like that translation. But if you have an inheritance, you better have wisdom, because if you've got all this money, you better know what to do with it. So it's good with an inheritance. That's really the meaning of the verse. Verse 19, wisdom strengthens the wise more than 10 mighty men which are in the city. Now, if you are facing a tremendous enemy, would you want 10 mighty men or would you want wisdom? For there's not a just man upon earth that does good and sins not, and take no heed unto all words that are spoken, unless you hear your servant curse you. I've learned not to do that, because I don't want to know what other people are saying about me sometimes. I've learned sometimes it's not what you want to hear. For oftentimes also your own heart knows that you yourself likewise have cursed others. Yep. All this have I proved by wisdom. I said I will be wise, and it was far from me. At times it wasn't there. That which is far off and exceeding deep, who can find it out? I applied my heart to know and to search and to seek out wisdom and the reason of things and to know the application or the wickedness of folly, even the foolishness and madness, or of foolishness. And I find more bitter than death the woman whose heart is snares and nets, and her hands as bands, and so forth. 27, behold, this have I found, says the preacher, counting one by one to find out the account very carefully. A guy who counts up to 3,000 proverbs and 100 or 1,005 songs would be a fellow who would count principles one by one, which yet my soul seeks, but I find not. One man among 1,000, counted up people as well, have I found. But a woman among all those have I not found. Well, it could sound like a chauvinist statement, but you understand what he's saying. Solomon tried out a lot of women, and it destroyed his life, but he only found one man out of 1,000. Lo, this only have I found, that God has made man upright, but they have sought out many inventions. God made people because he wanted them to walk upright and have integrity. But people don't choose to do that. They bow over into their inventions, their reasonings, their machinations. Number 4, exercise righteousness, Ecclesiastes 2:26. For God gives to a man that is good in his sight, he's godly, wisdom and knowledge and joy, but to the sinner he gives travail. So exercise righteousness, do what's right, and watch God give you more wisdom. You might write James 3:14-18 again. We've already read it, but you can go back there. Number 5, incline your ear. Listen for it. Turn to Proverbs 2. Turn to Proverbs 2 and verse 2. So that you incline your ear unto wisdom. Are you listening for it? You know, it says in verse 20 of the previous chapter, wisdom cries without, she utters her voice in the streets. I mean, do you ever just stop and realize wisdom standing out in front of your house in the street calling out to you? Are you listening, or you have your hands clamped over your ears like the people charging on Stephen? How are you doing? How am I doing? How are we doing? Verse 6, for the Lord gives wisdom, chapter 2, still there, out of his mouth comes knowledge and understanding. God will give it, and that's right in the context of listen for it. He lays up sound wisdom, here it is again, for the righteous. He is a buckler to them that walk uprightly. One of the things I try to remind the staff and try to remind myself, and God reminds all of us, is what we do in the restored church of God, what we do in the office, must be right. We'll make mistakes trying to do things that are right, but it must be right, and it must be righteous. And then if we mess up, and we repent, we go on, and we learn. But we've got to stand on that principle. And when you do, look at what happens. Chapter 3:13. Happy is the man that finds wisdom, and the man that gets understanding. No wonder the people around Solomon were happy. They chirped. They loved their life. He was good to them. He didn't chastise them with scorpions, which is what the young men told his son to do, and it split the kingdom. For the merchandise of it is better than the merchandise of silver, and the gain thereof than fine gold. Somebody says, here's a sack of Krugerrands or wisdom. Which do you want? Most people say, give me the Krugerrands. That's what they'd say. Give me the silver. Number 6. More faith equals more wisdom. More faith equals more wisdom, right here in the same chapter. Chapter 3, 5. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. If you trust God, He will lead you into wise paths. And lean not unto your own understanding. Remember, profess yourself to be foolish. Say, I don't have it. I don't know how to go out or come in. In all your ways acknowledge Him, and He shall direct your paths. Be not wise in your own eyes, but fear the Lord and depart from evil. Why? Because the fear of the Lord is the beginning of understanding and the beginning of wisdom. Point 7, simply seek it. Seek it. And you could put Proverbs 1, 20 to verse 33. That's a little different than point 5, which was incline your ear. I think that was point 5. Incline your ear to wisdom. That's listen for it. But point 7 is seek wisdom. Proverbs 1, 20 to 33. And the last point, Proverbs 11 and verse 2. Proverbs 11 and verse 2. Humble yourself. Anybody is going to recognize he's foolish and say, look, I don't have wisdom. I don't have a wise heart. Has to have this quality. Proverbs 11 and verse 2. When pride comes, then comes shame, but with the lowly is wisdom. It's a powerful, powerful statement. But with the lowly is wisdom. Proverbs 4, to conclude. Proverbs 4 and verse 4. Get wisdom. Well, I'm sorry, let's pick it up in verse 4. He taught me also and said unto me, let your heart retain my words, keep my commandments and live. Verse 5, get wisdom, get understanding. I mean, go get it. Forget it not. Brethren, it might keep you alive. You know, there are a lot of people out there in the world who are what's called survivalists. They think they've got it figured out. They know that they can find their own private mine shaft to survive what's coming. They live in retreats. They live in the hills. They've got food stored. They've got bunkers and bomb shelters and all kinds of other things. They've got weapons. And boy, they're going to be ready when the black helicopters come or whatever else is going to happen. They're called survivalists. But you know what? They're a counterfeit of what you do to really survive. Get wisdom. Get understanding. Forget it not. Neither decline from the words of my mouth. Forsake her not, and she shall preserve you. No mine shaft will. Love her, and she shall keep you. Wisdom is, correctly translated, a principal thing. Remember, we live in the age, brethren, when the wise understand what's happening. The wicked won't. Many will be tried, purified, made white. Some people won't even understand the most basic thing that the wise understand about the abomination of desolation. Therefore, get wisdom. And with all your getting, brethren of God, get understanding. Exalt her, and she shall promote you. She shall bring you to honor when you do embrace her. And the final honor that it will bring us to is when we stand over the number of cities that God gives to us at the end of our calling.